health is a crown worn by the healthy that only the ill can see. Your health really is your wealth. Join us for the next hour as we explore disease and attaining and maintaining good health. This is Dis-Chem Medical Monday, brought to you by Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
Good morning. It has just gone 8 minutes past 10. It's Monday morning, and that means it's time for the Dis-Chem Medical Monday show here on Chai FM. Welcome and thank you for joining us. We've got an incredible show for you today. I'm joined by, and I'm going to run through our incredible panel. We have Professor Lee Fairley. Did I get that right, Prof? Thank you. I'm famous for butchering names. My apologies.
That's fine.
Prof, you're Director of Mental and Child Health at WITS RHI. We have Roseanne Sack, co-founder of Kolenu. Wendy Hendler, co-founder of Kolenu. Dr. Elzette Rousseau, social behavior scientist at the Desmond Tutu Health Foundation. Absolutely fantastic. And we're also going to be joined later by Dr. Norma Temba Chandiwana, and she is director and principal scientist at the Isrinsa, Research Center. We're chatting all things gender-based violence and its effect on women and child's health. Last week was HIV Awareness Day, and we're going to be looking at the correlation there as well between gender-based violence and HIV and other STDs. So please let us have your questions and comments on 061-895-1019. And a big shout out to our producer Sina and our controller Craig. We look forward to you joining us.
This is Medical Monday, brought to you with the compliments of Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
We are chatting gender-based violence, and we are looking at the effects. We're starting off the show today looking at the effects of gender-based violence, such as the injuries it leads to, chronic pain, reproductive health issues, and the potential for long-term disability in women and children. I'd like to start off with Roseanne Sack from Kolenu. Roseanne, could you give us some of the actual consequences that are faced by victims of gender-based violence?
Thanks, Nick. Thanks so much for having me on. Okay, so obviously when it comes to domestic violence, you've got the physical effects for somebody who's been physically abused. And those are obviously the physical injuries, the bruises, the fractures, with sexual assault, there can be sexually transmitted diseases, there can be unwanted pregnancies. We often say with physical abuse, the signs are much more visible. With emotional and verbal abuse, there are no physical signs, so the victim can kind of say, yeah, look, here's the bruise, and here is the physical evidence of what I'm going through. But with emotional verbal abuse, it's much more nuanced and obvious, and often the victim suffers in silence because they're worried. There's a lot of fear, there's a lot of shame, there's a lot of guilt, and they also worry that people won't believe them, fear of reprisal from the perpetrator. So that often leads to complex PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. It leads to depression, anxiety, very low self-esteem. So a victim of emotional, verbal abuse will often find themselves struggling, to maybe maintain a job, to be active in community life, to keep relationships going. There's often substance abuse, suicidality. And the long-term consequences of that, obviously affect the ability to function. And most times, because it's so hard to talk about, often suffered in silence, either due to, as I explained, the shame or the guilt or the fear, or the fact that there just aren't enough resources available, or perhaps they are financially dependent on the abuser and they don't have any way to get help or get the resources that they need, this kind of suffering in silence leads to ongoing trauma and long-standing depression and kind of inability to function. That's why, you know, we felt like with our organization, our focus is on the sooner that we can get somebody help, the better the chances of them recovering and not carrying that kind of trauma and that, you know, all these, whether they're physical or emotional or psychological consequences of abuse into their future and into their future relationships, whether it be marriage with a partner, with their own children, with their family members. Yeah, so it's complex.
I think one of the things, and speaking from my personal experience, is that's affected is your relationship with yourself and how you view yourself and how you value yourself. Because if you're getting broken down all the time, then your relationship with yourself, your own value, suffers tremendously. So I'd like to... Go ahead.
The abuser is very often somebody close to the person, maybe somebody the person loves, respects, looks up to. Possibly they've been groomed by this person, and very often they are master manipulators. So they're masterful at making everybody love them and think they're the good person, but at the same time they're masterful at breaking down the victim's self-worth and self-esteem. So very often the victim will feel like it's them against the world because, you know, nobody will believe them that this person is capable. And who are they? You know, they've been, as you say, battered down. Their self-esteem has been battered down to such an extent that they just don't have the inner wherewithal to be able to reach out and get the help that they need.
That they need. I'd like to go to Professor Lee Feli, Director of Mental Health and Child Health at WITS. Professor, if we discuss the psychological effects, including PTSD, anxiety, depression, and the impact on self-esteem and the overall quality of life, I think our self-esteem and our self-worth, that's the foundation of who we are. How does the gender-based violence affect the victims?
So just to correct you there, I'm the director of maternal health, not mental health. Psychiatry is certainly not where I put my expertise. It's really okay. Much more around infectious diseases and HIV-related care. So just kind of putting that out there.
that's my reading, which always happens. So I think, well, then let's jump into the maternal and the child healthcare component of this right now as well, because particularly with World AIDS Day last week, what are the risks that victims are facing?
So, you know, I mean, obviously in a country like South Africa where they are still... Well, you know, where there are over 8 million people living with HIV, you know, we really remain one of the largest HIV programs globally. And obviously with that comes the risk of HIV infection. And obviously, you know, that is then sort of propelled or becomes more serious, obviously, when there are any other additional risk factors and where women really, yeah, and I'm going to talk particularly around women's health here, but where women really don't have the agency to be able to negotiate condoms. They may or may not have the agency to negotiate HIV prevention. So, I mean, the good news is that actually from an HIV prevention point of view, there are some very good new tools in the toolbox and really put, you know, the kind of power into women's hands around which options they would like to choose. And just to mention, and the audience may well be aware of these, but, you know, there's the oral PrEP options, There are injectable options, so cabotegravir, which is given every 2nd month. There's been some very exciting research about lenacapavir, which is a 6-monthly injection, and then also the dapivirine ring. So all of these prevention mechanisms actually, take power back to the woman in terms of being able to prevent HIV infection. Unfortunately, we know that women are still at higher risk. I think just recently, though, in the last few years, for the first time, in fact, in sub-Saharan Africa, there has been a reduction in the number of infections in women, which is good news. And when we look at our HIV, what we call seroprevalence, so the number, kind of proportion of people who are living with HIV while pregnant, again, for the first time in the last few years, that has started to decrease. So we're still sitting at about 27.5%, and there's a lot of variability between provinces, but that has certainly dropped, over the last few years. So gains made, but and just to mention that, the other big factor in terms of HIV prevention is actually having people on antiretrovirals, being virally suppressed, obviously much less likely then that through sexual contact that. That HIV will be transmitted. Unfortunately, when we look at mother to child or to vertical, to what we could now call vertical transmission, it's a little bit more complicated. And unfortunately, it doesn't always mean that if someone is suppressed that they won't transmit, but mostly, I mean, almost 100%, but we can't quite say 100%.
I'd like to touch on that as soon as we're back from the ad break, as well as also asking about the different prevention options in terms of the safety for women to use, meaning that where the partner, the abuser, may not actually be aware and it may then be better in their interests. Dis-Chem Wellness Clinic for Adults offer convenient and professional care to help you manage health risks. Whether you're having regular wellness checks, such as blood pressure or cholesterol, Dis-Chem Wellness Clinics offer you a broad range of health screening services, including female health screening with pap smears, family prayer planning, and pregnancy screening. Fast, affordable, and with care, find your nearest Dis-Chem Wellness Clinic inside Dis-Chem Pharmacies. Better health starts here.
This is Medical Monday, brought to you with the compliments of Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
We are chatting gender-based violence. We have an incredible panel with us. Let us have your questions on the WhatsApp number 0618951019. We were just chatting and putting the poor professor under a lot of pressure there with giving you a new discipline, mental health. Maternal health. So, chatting about sort of the mother-to-child transmission, and I want to go through this, and then also just in terms of the safety, because when I was growing up, when I was younger, the only option really were condoms, and that in an abusive relationship really is not an option. So, it's wonderful to hear these developments and what's been done. And then after you, Professor, I'd like to go back to Roseanne because she has to leave at 10:30. So, Prof, can we chat about mother-to-child transmission, the risks, what's happening, and then just cover the protection options that are available?
So mother-to-child transmission is now, just to be more correct around it, called vertical transmission, really. And that's a lot of trying to take, and it was my mistake, I used that term, but really just to try and take the blame out from anyone in terms of HIV transmission, because as we know, HIV is a family disease. So for people and for women living with HIV, currently all women are essentially placed on a dolutegravir-based regimen, which would be a first or second line treatment regimen. We know that, you know, that includes three drugs in the modern day treatment era, and that is a fixed dose combination tablets. And, you know, it's very robust in terms of actually making sure that viral suppression is achieved. This regimen has got a lot less side effects than, you know, the regimens that we used sort of 15, 20 years ago. You know, the field has really moved remarkably. And so that is really the mainstay for most people. Obviously, you know, pregnancy and particularly the sort of postpartum period, you know, there's breastfeeding, there's the chaos of sort of trying to get back to work and, you know, various different things for women. And often what we find is that that particular period ends up being a time that can be quite difficult for good adherence. And, you know, I think we can all think about, even when we're taking antibiotics or anything else, you know, any additional chaos or any, you know, anything else crammed into our lives really makes it very, very difficult. So that is a difficult period. And we don't always see, you know, what we really want to see is that at least 95% of people are what we call virally suppressed. So we can't see the virus when we're trying to measure it. It's still there, but it's just completely suppressed. So, but certainly, you know, there have been tremendous gains in terms of preventing infection for infants, but then also improving maternal health through antiretrovirals. There's still about 8,000 children probably in South Africa who become infected each year. But again, you know, massive reduction from 2010. But obviously, we need [S2] Right. [S1] To be aware of this. We need to make sure that these kids get diagnosed. Then, because obviously with HIV, the sooner you get onto treatment, you know, you can expect to live a full, normal, healthy life. Many people may not even know that somebody is HIV infected. So the goal really is to, when someone's diagnosed, to get them onto treatment as quickly as possible. Just to mention, especially during pregnancy, they're very frequent times that HIV testing is conducted. What we're wanting to try and do is, again, to diagnose someone with HIV as quickly as possible. So someone becomes infected during their pregnancy, we want to make that diagnosis and get them onto treatment as quickly as possible. There's been a lot of research around the antiretroviral drugs. Obviously, you know, one can, there may be people who have side effects, but certainly on the whole, these drugs are safe. They've generally been very well studied. And then maybe you were asking just about the prevention mechanism. So, you know, all of the preventative therapies have also to some extent been studied in pregnancy. So oral PrEP has frequently been studied in pregnancy. Cabotegravir, which is an injectable, they're increasing data that's coming out from women who become pregnant on those products. And then the dapivirine ring, there has been data really showing safety in mothers and then in children exposed to that product. And then lenacapavir, actually the study had no restrictions. So usually these studies are quite restrictive around people who are, you know, potentially going to become pregnant. There were no restrictions at all on lenacapavir. So also some reassuring data coming from those studies.
Thank you so much. Well, that was a lot of information quickly. That was fantastic. Thank you. Just before Roseanne has to leave us, I want to touch again on the psychological effects, the PTSD, the anxiety, the depression, all of these things that erode the victim's quality of life long after the abuse has stopped.
Sorry, could you repeat that? I've got such a bad
Sure.
connection.
I just want to,
really
I'd like to chat about
the cancer.
Okay, no problem.
Not good, I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, you're at the Benaya Kiva campsite and there's no good Wi-Fi. The kids must be going nuts. want to talk
yeah,
about the long-term... Okay, I'm going to ask the question and then let you go for it. The long-term effects, the psychological effects with PTSD, anxiety, depression, self-esteem that affect the victim long after the abuse has stopped. Can we touch on that, please? Roseanne, can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah, I think I got the question. The long-term effects that can occur long after the abuse has stopped.
Yes.
So I think, yeah, I mean, I think it depends very much on the level of help that the victim has received and at what stage in the process they receive the help. Obviously, the sooner they receive help, the higher the probability that they can heal, that they could, go on to live fairly normal lives with healthy relationships. But most times, I mean, the average at the moment, a child who's sexually abused, for example, the average is between 30 and 40 years before they disclose the abuse. So most times they take that secret with them into adulthood. Most times they take that secret with them to the grave. So it means that long term they're suffering most of their lives with levels of depression. There's a lot of anxiety. We see suicidality a lot. We've just actually done a segment with the male child, the male victims as well, in terms of how hard it is for the boy child to speak up for many, many reasons. There's much more shame that goes with being a male victim, the toxic masculinity, I need to be strong, I can't show vulnerability, I can't disclose that I've been abused. So they just keep quiet. And they are 2 to 5 times more likely to commit suicide than a female victim for whom it is as hard, but in a way easier to come forward because it's kind of more the, societal norm that a victim is female. So it's all those complexities. So there's definitely substance abuse, long-term, high suicide rates, depression, anxiety, inability, it affects obviously their working lives going forward, inability to hold down a job, inability to form attachments and relationships. And I mean, in general, we see with victims that have carried this for many, many, many years, dysfunction throughout their lives in all areas of their life, and eating disorders as well come through a lot. You'll often
Right.
find that a victim of sexual abuse will do what they can to become unattractive. So they don't want to invite any kind of attention. So that's where your eating disorder might come in. It may be overeating. There may be anorexia or bulimia because it's one area in their life where they feel they have control over what is happening to their body. So it can manifest in that instance. You might find a deterioration in grooming habits, long term, not caring what they look like, actually wanting to be unattractive to just not attract any attention to themselves. So there are many, many long term consequences going forward, unfortunately.
So I know you have to leave us, and we'll hopefully let
I
Wendy answer
agree
the
on that
question. But
one.
okay, so
Yeah.
with the work that you've done, there is help. There are good stories that coming forward to, I'm going to say this, it's going to be difficult, coming forward to the right people is really, what's important, because a lot of people do not understand. They can't process the fact that someone that they know, someone in their family may have been abused. And, a lot of the time it's just like, well, that's in the past. Just leave it. Just move on. It's not necessary to talk about. Roseanne, have you got some stories for us or something you can share just to give victims hope and understanding that help is available and it can work?
Right. So, I mean, the purpose of our organization is that we offer a helpline that's anonymous and confidential. So you can choose whether you want to give your name or not. And we have helpline responders who are trained in basic telephone counseling. But I think the strength of what we do is that we're able to make a very targeted referral for help. So we're not going to just accept somebody and send them for to someone generic for therapy or for help. We assess the particular situation and we see where we think they they really need the help. And we've got a large referral base that we are able to make that targeted referral. And I think that is really the key, is that if you send somebody for the right kind of help, that they start to feel that they're heard, that they're healing, that something is shifting, then it kind of encourages them to carry on with that. And it encourages the healing process and for them to stick with the process, you know, whereas if you're just going to kind of refer generically, they often feel that, well, you know, it's just talk therapy and I'm just saying the same thing over again and nothing's really shifting for me. Whereas there are so many different modalities these days. There's your EMDR, which is your eye movement desensitization, which is works with processing trauma in the brain, which we refer for a lot. So there's definitely, you know, things are changing, things are progressing all the times in terms of therapy around this type of trauma and processing it in the brain. And I just think that, you know, the sooner somebody reaches out for help, the sooner to whoever, whichever organization it is or wherever, the first step is just the acknowledgement that this is not my fault. I didn't do anything to cause this. I am in need of help. I am in need of support. I'm going to reach out and get that support. And just that first step alone is huge in getting the process started to healing.
It's the understanding of I deserve help. And as you said, it wasn't my fault. I'm worthy of trying to live a different life rather than carrying this help, self-loathing and this low self-opinion and self-esteem with me all the time. Roseanne, thank you so much for your time on that. We know you have to run. We really do appreciate you taking the time to join us. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. I want to go to Dr. Elsa Letroux, social behavior scientist at the Desmond Tutu Health Foundation, and just get the doctor's view and opinion on what we've discussed. Doc, thank you again for your time and for joining us.
Thank you so much. I think a lot has been said today already, but I just wanted to also highlight that we speak about a lot of these, you know, good therapies and some services available, but we need to also acknowledge that within this framework of gender inequality, it also limits women's access to resources and healthcare. And I think especially in communities like South Africa, where gender-based violence is both stigmatized but also normalized, it becomes really difficult for people, and they might be reluctant to disclose their experiences, which complicates really these efforts to combat both gender-based violence and then HIV prevention. And I think with that being said, we need to also make sure that we sensitize people that get into contact with people who might have experienced gender-based violence, especially if they might be reluctant to disclose. This is not just speaking to police officers, we know everything going around there, but really to our healthcare providers to understand, to not get into re-victimization. But if we know that it is difficult for women to get to our services, to make sure that we make that visit count. When you see someone in front of you, you know, to probe and to have that discussion, make them feel comfortable, and then provide them with these options that could protect them against HIV, as that is specifically what we are speaking about now, but also the other sexual and reproductive health services around it, like unwanted pregnancies, STIs, etc.
Right. What does one do where women in rural South Africa, or even, you know, sort of inner cities where there's poverty, there's not access to facilities, one may not even have a mobile phone or, you know, funds for airtime, that you can call a call center, that you can reach out? What can one do at grassroots level? And then also a follow-up question on that, what can we in society do just to make ourselves a little bit more supportive and understanding?
That's a big question, especially the second part. But it does come to something I saw recently where it said that only 56% of women have access to the healthcare needs that they have. South Africa has a good public health system. We know that we have community health workers, we have mobile clinics going out, etc. So I think in those instances, we speak about your rural setting, for all types of settings, we really need to make our medical provision and reaching people easy and convenient to get to people, especially if we know that their access and their movement might be restricted. Like, how do we take healthcare to the people? How do we take messaging to the people? And then the larger difficult question, I think it is about we need to shift the stigma and also not normalize intimate partner violence or gender-based violence. And we need to have these conversations, and we need to call it out when we see it happening, when we hear, you know, these jokes that we hear about it, that is not okay, to call that out, to call out heteronormative masculinity, and to really start engaging with people and link them to care.
Right. I think, Doc, we're going to go to an ad break now. When we come back, I'd just like to get your advice a little bit more on what would you say to the general public, members of the community, just how we, through our accent, as you said, don't joke about it, don't normalize it, take a little bit more responsibility and sensitivity to it. How do we, as member of the public, just maybe change something within our attitude to help victims of gender-based violence? We'll get onto that as soon as we're back from these ads. Let us have your questions on 061-895-1019.
This is Medical Monday, brought to you with the compliments of Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
You listening to 101.9 High FM. It's the Dis-Chem Medical Monday show. I'm your host, Nicholas Ingle, and I'm joined by an absolutely incredible panel. I don't know how Sina does it, our producer. She absolutely rocks. We were chatting just before we went to ad break with Dr. Elsalet Rousseau about the socio-behavioral impacts of gender-based violence. And just before we went to ads, we asked the doctor to give us her views on what we can do as a society. We briefly touched on that, and I'd like to go into that a little bit more with the doctor. Doc, just a few points if you could give us as society, how we could change our behavior to change, you know, just benefit potential victims or victims of gender-based violence. Doc, you are, all right, thank you. I was going to say, you were on mute. Okay, thank you, Doc, just very quickly.
Thank you. I think I'll just do it in one thing. And so similarly to what we say to healthcare workers, to take a person-centered approach, I think as a society, we need to take a person-centered approach wherever we are. So everyone that you engage with that's in front of you is a person on their own. They are human. And I think this is something that we know, you know, in a broader South African culture, about caring about people, about being a community and being and standing together with each other. So I think that will be my overarching comment on that.
Absolutely. Thank you. And that'll only also enhance our quality of life when we start to see one another as people. I'd like to go to Dr. Nonatemba Chandiwana. Doc, I hope as well I got that right. She is
yes, you got it right.
Woohoo!
Yay for Monday.
Yay for Monday, absolutely. Director and principal scientist at the Ezintsha Research Center. Could you give us a little bit of background on your work and your thoughts also on gender-based violence?
Okay. Well, good morning to everyone and your listeners. So I've recently changed roles. I work with LZ at DTHF, but the work is still the same. Yeah. So our work is really around HIV prevention and treatment. And just to give an HIV angle, I know Dr. Fairley spoke about it a little bit earlier, is that people living with HIV at a higher risk of both gender-based violence and intimate partner violence. So about 50% for women and about 20% for men. And if you're looking at diverse populations living with HIV, these are transgender populations, men who have sex with men, sex workers, you know, you can imagine how risky that is and what intimate partner violence, gender-based violence and HIV come together. So there are a few reasons for that, but in a nutshell, I mean, we're in a tough economic environment. South Africa has got a lot of issues, right? We're a great country, but violence is pervasive in our society. And this really comes out with HIV infection because think about it, you're a young woman, you're dating a gentleman who's older than you, the power dynamics are totally different, right? So the things that you'd want to do to protect yourself, using things like PrEP, which is a tablet that you take every day to prevent HIV, or condoms, for example, it may be difficult for you to negotiate that. And that's true also even in marriages and in same-sex relationships as well. So you're finding because of that gender imbalance and power imbalance, you're not able to negotiate safer sex, and that puts you at higher risk for HIV.
Right. Thank you so much, Doc. How big a correlation is there? And it sounds like a silly question, but I'd like to unpack this. Between South Africa's socioeconomic state, between the poverty and the value that people are able to place on themselves versus the need for some sort of support, where, you know, maybe with dating an older man, where there's a financial, I don't want to use the word reward, but there is a financial component to that relationship. How big a component is our socioeconomic state, South Africa's society, in this, in our high levels of gender-based violence?
You know, Nicholas, it's huge, right? So we have the second gap. It's called the Gini coefficient between those that have and those that don't have. Mm-hmm. Same with a country like Brazil. And because of those dynamics, it's the same when it comes to also our personal safety, right? We're going into the festive period. It's the same dynamics when it also comes to gender-based violence. And it's not always as simple as you can think about it. So we did a study actually with Dr. Lee. We used to work together a few years ago in her site. And it was asking women at Shandukani about violence. And I think what surprised me is that what we would consider, right, a woman in different circumstances would consider violence, but she would say, I mean, this is one interview I'll never forget. She said, in the third week of the month, when funds are dry, right, I provoke a fight. So he beats me and he feels bad and he gives me money at the end of the month. So we are working in a totally different environment. So you are actually anticipating. So I think when it comes to like violence, intimate partner violence, it's not so simple. People do a lot of things for the survival of themselves and for their family and children.
Yeah. I think it's one thing that we know. A mother will do whatever she can with her limited with her limited options to support her kids. And if that does mean being beaten in order to get some extra funds out to help her through the end of the month, that's something that she would do. We're going to go to a quick ad break. I actually need a minute because that really hit me quite hard. And we'll chat a little bit more about that when we're back from the ads.
This is Medical Monday, brought to you with the compliments of Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
We are chatting gender-based violence with an incredible panel, and I'm very, very grateful for Sina for putting this together. We were just chatting now with Dr. Nonna Temba, talking about a story that she had heard where a woman would provoke a fight to be beaten so that she could get some extra funding. And this is something that I understand very, very well, because as a young child, I went willingly to be abused by my mother's drug dealers because I thought at the age of six, if I did a good enough job, I could get my mother to love me. And I think this is something that we need to understand with victims as well, that you are going through something that no person should ever go through. and you're doing your best to try to deal with it, to try and cope with it, and you may be acting in ways that are going to hurt you in the long run, destroy your self-esteem in the long run. But what I would like to start to wrap up the show on is this. If we could each, from each of our panelists, get a little bit of optimism, some hope, and some advice and recommendations on what to do. Wendy from Kolenu, co-founder, Wendy Hendler, if we could start with you, please.
Well, what we're very proud of within Kolenu is our School Safe Prevention of Child Sexual Abuse program, which we're running in many of the Jewish and we've done in some of the wider primary schools as well over many years. And with that program, we teach both parents, teachers, and then children how to keep themselves safe from abuse, not in a scary way, but in a fun, engaging way, but teaching them EQ skills. For example, teaching them a wider range of feelings, that no feelings are not good or bad. Feelings are all acceptable. And then how to feel your feelings in your body. For example, is your heart racing if you're in an uncomfortable situation? Is your tummy tight? These are your early warning signals that something may not be right. And if you feel anything like that, you need to talk to a safe adult and get help. We teach them about secrets, good secrets and bad secrets, that good secrets are short term and they're exciting and make you feel wonderful feelings, whereas bad secrets are wrapped up in secrecy and last long into the future and make you feel scared and come with intimidation and threats. We teach them about their body parts, that they're sacred and that they have body autonomy, that they're allowed to decide who can hug them and kiss them and who can't, and that they need to trust that they're in charge of their bodies. And when something is done to them that breaches that boundary, they need to speak out and get help. And they need just a network of safe adults. So if the one adult doesn't listen, they go to the next and the next. So these are skills that will take them into adulthood and hopefully keep them safe from many problematic situations. So that's very exciting, and we want to get that out more and more.
Wendy Hendler, thank you. And that's some great advice as well, particularly for the kids. Very important. Let's go to Professor Lee Fairley. Probably if you could give us just 30 seconds to wrap up what you would advise for victims or potential victims.
Sure, Nicholas, and I'm going to speak mainly around the sort of HIV aspects. I think they're really, you know, there has been exciting development in the past sort of 20 years, but, you know, the battle is not over yet. And I think just to add to the points that others have made around access, you know, we know that some of these prevention options even are really not that easily accessible. They're accessible through what we call demonstration projects and hopefully will become kind of mainstream soon. But of course there are options. So like oral PrEP, for example, is readily available. But I think just to sort of encourage people to, you know, there are ways that, you know, that you can protect yourself, and obviously it may be very difficult in certain circumstances. But you know, certainly there are good options available. And I think really just to encourage people, you know, to seek those out and to try and really protect themselves as much as possible, and not only from HIV but from STIs. Make sure that they're keeping up with their routine health checks that are necessary. Because, you know, ultimately, I guess that is in their hands, but needs to be kind of facilitated by the system and by everybody else.
Right. So thanks. I think also, so hearing what you, keep trusting the system, keep looking for people within the system that we can access. Very, very quickly, Dr. Elset Rousseau, just a quick word from you as we wrap up, please. And then we'll go on to Dr. Namachandran. Sorry, go ahead.
No, so I would just say to try to encourage people to try to get you in front of a healthcare provider, if that's feasible, and then to healthcare providers to take that person-centered approach and make the most of any engagement that you have with someone sitting in front of you.
Thank you. I love that. A person-centered approach. Fantastic. And last but certainly not least, Dr. Norma Temba.
So in addition to what everybody has said, just to give a different angle, one thing we do is that we've got a community gym. that is a safe space for people, right? So exercise also is burning that aggression and other things out, right? And also it helps with mental health things around working. So this is physical activity as a mental health intervention, which is important, which is really, really important for all of us, but particularly for young people. So I would add that to everything that's been said.
And absolutely, and I will second that because I've seen its incredible benefit. Thank you so much for joining us. What an incredible panel. And thank you for everything that you've shared. I know that it's going to make a difference. I'm going to wrap up by saying this. I've been at points in my life where I've sat in my couch with my gun in my mouth asking God to give me the courage to kill myself because I could not go on. I couldn't deal with what was happening or with what happened when I was a child, and just reach out. I'm here today because someone took the time to talk to me. So thank you for listening to us. Thank you for this incredible panel. We are not our abuse, and we are far more than that. So thank you, everyone, and look forward to chatting to you next week.